Hey, CE Plan members from CE Impact, this is Game Changers. I have a few people with me today to lean on for this conversation because it is a big one and one that we all need to understand as healthcare providers because there's so much misinformation and we're trying to do a lot of good for patients. So sometimes it might feel like patients know more about this than we do. And so we want to ensure that that is not the case and provide you with adequate information. I think we're all on the same page in saying that the advent of GLP-1s is a true game changer. It has enabled people to not only lose weight effectively, but it has also improved the health of patients with diabetes and cardiovascular diseases that are tied to carrying excess weight. So I think the benefits of this are still even to come. I feel like I keep seeing studies that are like, it's good for this, it's good for this. And so that will continue. That said, you know, we're still early on in this as well. So I know people are, you know, a little nervous about the risk and long-term benefits and risk associated with it as well. But as with any new medication, you know, I also think we're all aware that there have been some exploitations and, you know, things that maybe aren't being done legally. And so our goal here today is to really talk about the benefit of these medications in therapy and also how to do it the right way. So I think, you know, shortages, the desire to initially to have them off label when there wasn't an approved medication for weight loss, but it was working, have led the marketplace to compounding some of these products. And whenever we're dealing with compounds that are commercially available, you know, there's always issues there. So here with us to talk about that are a few people. First, our regular conversationalist and contributor, Jeff Wall. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. How you doing?
Great. And also two people from the Alliance for Pharmacy Compounding, Scott Bruner and Tennille Davis. So thank you both and welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So first I'd like to start, Scott and Tennille, can you each just take a minute to tell us about the Alliance for Pharmacy Compounding and its place in pharmacy? And then as well a little bit about your role, you and your role with APC.
Yeah, I'll be happy to start and then hand off to Tennille. I am the CEO of the Alliance for Pharmacy Compounding. We are a trade association. We are the industry association for pharmacy compounding. And our members are, of course, pharmacists and technicians, but also supply chain professionals and marketing professionals and educators and even some prescribers and a handful of patients. We represent around 500 compounding pharmacies or outsourcing facilities. And that amounts to around 47, maybe just shy of 4,800 members. And our job is to protect patient access to compounded medications. Compounded medications are an essential line of therapy in the American healthcare system. As we'll, I'm sure we'll discuss, compounding is not always as well known to prescribers and patients and others. And I think the light that is being shown on compounding right now is an opportunity to talk about the benefits of those therapies.
Great. Thanks, Scott. Yeah. As we were talking about, you know, pharmacy started by compounding. So that is our mainstay. And sometimes it does get a bad rap. So I think it'll be great to talk through that. Tennille, can you tell us a little bit about your role?
Sure. Yeah. At its heart, APC is an advocacy organization, and I'm lucky enough to have been brought in recently. I just started with the organization in February as the chief advocacy officer. So we do a lot of work for our members to educate, you know, different, you know, regulators of pharmacy, as well as the media and the public about what compounding is, what compounding is not, and help clarify any rules or laws that are being proposed that might, you know, limit or hinder patient access to compounded medications. Since I've been, you know, brought on, been after the GLP-1 phase started, and we've done a lot of media interviews to try to help correct misinformation out there. My history, I ran a sterile and non-sterile compounding pharmacy for 16 years in Arizona before I came on with APC. I also am a member of the Arizona State Board of Pharmacy, though I am speaking today on my personal capacity and not as a member of the board.
Yes, that's an important message. I didn't realize you had only been there since February. So yeah, you've been thrown right in, but sounds like your background is great and you have a lot to bring to the table. So I'm so happy to have you on today. We are looking forward to this conversation. So let's get into it. first, I guess I'll tee it up and then maybe pass it off to Jeff. But how did we get here? So maybe, sort of, I know that's a, maybe we'll be here for an hour and a half just talking about that. But how did we get to this space? I think with GLP-1s in particular, and I know Scott, maybe you touched a little bit on just compounding in general. So maybe even talk about that a little bit.
I think how we got here is the advent of a blockbuster drug that, frankly, nobody, in defense of Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly, I don't think anybody could have predicted the splash that this drug has made. I hear pharmacists who've been around for 40 or 50 years doing compounding say they've never seen anything like it. It's bigger than the AIDS drugs. It may be equivalent to the advent of birth control in the 1950s and 1960s. And with the extraordinary demand for that drug and the inability of the drug manufacturers to keep up with that demand, so enters compounding into the equation. FDA guidance allows compounding pharmacies to prepare essentially a copy, and that's the exact wording, essentially a copy of an FDA-approved drug when that drug formally appears on the FDA drug shortage list. Semaglutide has been on the drug shortage list since March of 2022. Tirzepatide, not quite as long, but they both are on that list. And so compounders have been responding to prescribers who are directing their patients to compounded versions of these drugs. I do want to make clear to your listeners, nothing happens in traditional compounding until a doctor or other prescriber writes a prescription for a patient. Compounders don't just get to decide when they're going to dispense a compounded drug. The doctor has to specifically write the prescription for that patient for that drug. So it's not as if the doctor writes Wegovy on the script and the patient hops down to the pharmacy and the pharmacist says, "Oh, I don't have any of that. Let me compound something for you." The doctor must, or other prescriber, must write the script for semaglutide or tirzepatide. And then it goes to a state-licensed pharmacy that dispenses medications pursuant to a prescription for an individual patient. And I'm sure we'll talk shortly about how do you distinguish between what's legitimate and what's not. But that's the first question. Do you have a prescription for it? And the second question would be, has the physician sent you to a state-licensed pharmacy to have that medication dispensed? If neither of those things is true, either of those things is not true, there's a good chance the activity might be illicit. So we can talk more about that, I suspect.
Yeah, and Scott, when you say formerly on the list,
Formally, sorry,
oh, formally. Okay, I thought you said
that's my
formerly. So I'm like,
Alabama
well, was that
drawl.
forever? Yeah,
No, my
formally on the
Alabama
list.
drawl gets in the way sometimes.
Yeah,
Sorry.
and how often is that list updated?
Tennille, you want to talk about that? It's updated ongoing.
It is
It's
updated on.
not perfect, but yeah, go ahead.
It's not ongoing. The FDA does update that list very frequently. We always recommend that pharmacy compounders that are compounding something on the shortage list, especially something that might be protected by a patent otherwise, keep their documentation up to date. So I usually recommend, taking a screenshot of the drug shortage list on FDA's website at least once a week and storing that indefinitely to prove that if ever a regulator came in and said, was it on shortage when you were compounding it, you can pull up that week's data and say, yes, it was.
Yeah,
It's
that's
not
lovely.
updated as frequently as some other drug shortage lists, like the ASHP list, which is a little more rapidly adapting to what changes are happening in the marketplace, but it's not by any means like goes on the list and then the FDA forgets about it.
Yeah, never.
There
Yeah, it doesn't happen.
are some certain tricky things with the FDA drug shortage list, though, that folks should know. Again, the exact language in FDA guidance is the drug has to be listed as, quote, currently in shortage. If you go to the FDA drug shortage list and look around, you might find indications that certain dosage forms and dosage strengths of Wegovy and Ozempic and Mounjaro are, quote, available. The FDA drug shortage list, the website, is very confusing in that regard. But just because it's listed as those certain dosage forms are listed as available, that's not what the guidance says. It is semaglutide or tirzepatide injection that must be listed as currently in shortage. And that's what I hadn't checked it today, but as of very recently, that's how those are listed there. And so someone might say, well, if semaglutide injection is in shortage, how are compounders getting the API, the active pharmaceutical ingredient? And Tennille can talk a little bit more about this, but it's our understanding. Well, first of all, the API is readily accessible from FDA registered facilities, and compounders can only acquire API that comes from an FDA registered facility. It's actually, as we understand it, the pen to inject the drug that is creating the shortage right now. And Tennille, you may want to elaborate a bit on that because it creates confusion. People are saying, how can compounders get the API if the drug's in shortage? And again, it's not the API that's in shortage.
Yeah, the drug shortage list lists, semaglutide or tirzepatide injection as what is currently in shortage. But as you'll notice, Rybelsus semaglutide tablets are not in shortage because there really isn't a shortage of the API itself. If you go on FDA's website, you can find all of the FDA registered manufacturers of semaglutide API on there. Novo Nordisk is listed, but a lot of other ones are as well. Compounding pharmacies are required to source any of their API that they use in a compounded product from FDA registered wholesalers that are required to get their API from FDA registered manufacturers, which must come with a valid certificate of analysis, licensure in the state, all of those kind of things. So there's a lot of kind of hoopla in the media that says, if Novo Nordisk can't supply Ozempic injections, where are the pharmacies getting this? What must it be? And a lot of, speculation that is not necessarily warranted. Additionally, the manufacturers have come out with statements saying that they don't sell the API to compounding pharmacies. And, our response to that has been, well, of course they don't. Typically, drug manufacturing companies use contract manufacturers to manufacture API for them. They might put that in the final dosage form in factories that they own, like, put the injection solution into a pen device. They also might use contract manufacturers to do that part. But of course, they're not selling API to compounders because that's not how the system works in general. It's a, kind of a misleading statement, but it, makes sense coming from someone trying to protect their financial interests and, their product that they've done the R&D for.
Yeah, absolutely. Jeff, I'm going to turn it over to you. I have lots of questions, but I know you have a lot of questions too. So I want to make sure you get yours asked.
Yeah, and we have a limited time too. So,
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, I appreciate the clarification because I agree that there are a lot of misconceptions out there, and I think the problem, at least as I see it, from kind of outside this world, is that, I think there is a general thought, as Tennille pointed out, that there's this general like, well, how can they get this drug if the manufacturers themselves can't make it available? And I think there's a lot of confusion there. I think Scott had pointed out that he'd never seen anything like this, and I have to admit, I'm a little more skeptical because I'm old enough that I did see this. I did see this with Fen-Phen. And I remember when I came out of school, the Fen-Phen craze had just started, and it was pretty much the same thing. You couldn't keep it on the shelves. There were these weight loss clinics popping up all over the place, and basically they were a broom closet, a weight scale, and a credit card machine, and that's pretty much all you needed. And of course, in the 21st century, we've moved on to telehealth and telemedicine, which is a good thing. But I think there is some concern that not all compounding pharmacies are operating at the level of rigor that I think probably members of your organization are. And so I think the first question is, it sounds to me like the ability to purchase this medication. I think there's a lot of misconceptions out there saying that, pharmacies, compounding pharmacies are getting it from China or India, and we're not really sure, what's actually in it. There may not be anything in it. What do you guys think about that?
I think that that's a lot of, misplaced hysteria, honestly. Sure, there are counterfeit drug manufacturers out there. That's not compounding. There are sellers of research-grade peptides on the internet. That's not compounding. A lot of those things are being conflated with legitimate compounding, and it's not a fair comparison. But I understand that it's confusing. The regulatory framework that surrounds compounding is confusing, and it's a lot easier for people to say, it's not FDA approved, so thus it must be unsafe, which is not a logical fallacy, but that is the jump that people are making because it's an easier one-size-fits-all solution for patients than trying to understand the nuance of legitimate compounding versus all of the other stuff that is in, you know, the media.
Right.
But if a doctor, you know, wanted to use a compounding pharmacy to help supply a medicine to their patients that they weren't able to get otherwise, there's a lot of different steps that that provider or patient could take to make sure that they're dealing with a company that's legitimate. You know, you can always look on a state board of pharmacy website to make sure that that pharmacy is actually a real pharmacy and that exists. You can also call and talk to the pharmacist. If you have questions about processes, where they get their API from, if you wanted to see a copy of a C of A, any reasonable, legitimate pharmacist that doesn't have anything to hide wouldn't have any reason with providing that to you. An average consumer probably can't read a C of A, but if you asked for one and the pharmacist was like, no, 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 that to me would seem like a red flag, because if there's nothing to hide, you know, there is nothing to hide. So it's that lack of nuance in like the media and reporting that's like hurting our consumers and also making them afraid to use compounded meds in general, like patients that is their only option. There isn't an FDA approved alternative that happens to be on shortage. Like the, you know, us vilifying an entire industry because counterfeit drugs exist isn't fair, but I understand that that's a lot easier for the public to understand than the very complicated framework that surrounds compounding pharmacies.
I was going to say, I think it's also like the other way around. I mean, I think there's so many people that I know going to med spas that are just, you know, they're very trusting. And so like, what are some of the questions that should be asked in those spaces?
Well, we can both address that, but I do want to go back to something that was said earlier about the rigor of compounding pharmacies. I would be the first to acknowledge that any profession, any industry has its bad actors, but the compounding pharmacies that are preparing injectable GLP-1s are sterile compounding labs. They automatically must adhere to a higher standard of care and compliance, USP 797, that's the chapter of the US Pharmacopeia that guides sterile compounding, as well as the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, FDA guidance, state law. A compounding pharmacy is simply not going to stay in business very long if it doesn't adhere to those standards. The State Board of Pharmacy will come in and inspect them. The FDA will come in and inspect them, et cetera. And so generally speaking, I would assert that the pharmacies that are preparing compounded GLP-1s are doing it adherent to those standards. And so when I said earlier, your prescriber writes a prescription for you and sends you to that state licensed pharmacy, you can have some sense of confidence that that pharmacy is adhering to those standards. If indeed you've checked the Board of Pharmacy website and they haven't been written up for violations, et cetera. The conflation, the problem is with drug manufacturers, and most recently, bless his heart, the FDA commissioner himself, who conflated legitimate compounding with some of that illicit activity. And so I don't think you can refer to something you buy on the internet without a prescription as a compounded drug. It's not. It's an illicit substance.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. Yeah. But I think the question, and to Jen's point, is that I know myself in town here where we are, and I'm sure this is happening all over the United States, where people are going to these med spas and they show up and again, it's like the old weight loss clinics of the fenfender. They walk in, they go on a scale, they say, yep, you're a candidate. And they literally hand them 3 months of semaglutide injectable. Where are they getting it from? And how can the consumer and their overriding primary care physician go, yes, just what you said, this is a trusted source. You know, we know what's going on. And I think that's the key is that, you're right. There's bad actors in all areas of pharmacy, no doubt. And bad apples, you know, kind of ruin those things. But because this is something that's outside of what most experienced of providers are understanding, you said yourself that they often don't understand what compounding is. I think there is a legitimate concern among providers and pharmacists who are unaware of what's going on because they don't understand that, you know, like what you just said, that there is for legitimate compounding pharmacies, this extremely regimented FDA, FDA approved, but process that allows, appropriate drug to be sent. And so I think that's the key. I certainly, think that certain subspecialties of medicine, dermatology, other types who are very used to seeing, compounded medications, right? Because so often the medications they're using, ophthalmology, just literally don't exist, right? And
Correct.
they absolutely rely on compounded pharmacies. I think this is a little bit different because I think there is the thought, for better or worse, that chicanery can occur. And I think that's the key, is less, here's a prescription for X patient for Y semaglutide, and they're going to go to a compounding pharmacy to get it filled. That I don't think there's the problem. I think there's a lot of questions again about these kind of online or med spas that they're literally handing them months' supplies of the drug. And I think that's the question.
Yeah, well, and again, let's talk about telehealth platforms and about med spas. I'm going to make some sweeping generalizations, so if you'll allow me to speculate, I would suspect that the majority of dispensing of compounded GLP-1s right now is between an individual doctor and a patient, and the prescription is filled by a state licensed compounding pharmacy. With the telehealth platforms, there are also contract pharmacies that fulfill for the telehealth platforms, and Tennille can address this more fully. The question there for the pharmacy that is doing that fulfillment is there a legitimate patient prescriber relationship? And then you've got med spas, and again, sweeping generalization, but generally speaking, those don't tend to be owned by pharmacies. They tend to be owned by physicians, et cetera. And it's our understanding that some of the compounding that goes on with those med spas is physician clinic compounding, which is honestly regulated differently than pharmacy is regulated. Generally speaking, oversight over that, well, there's some question of who actually has authority. Pharmacy boards would tell you that if a physician is doing compounding themselves, the pharmacy board doesn't have much authority to regulate. And of course, the medical board is looking at that and saying, oh, it's the board of pharmacy because it's compounding, but a physician is doing it. And so I don't have the same confidence, honestly, in some of the compounding that might be going on by a physician and his or her staff as I do for the compounding that would go on with a state licensed sterile compounding pharmacy.
Yeah, I
Tennille, come on.
completely agree.
You want to add color there?
Sure. I would just like to point out that med spas are not pharmacies. That's not
Right.
compounding.
Right.
Med spas are entirely other businesses. There's two main types of categorization of compounding pharmacies, 503A pharmacies and 503B pharmacies. 503A pharmacies must dispense patient-specific prescriptions written by an individual provider for an individual patient. If you can walk into a med spa and step on a scale and get handed medication, there's a 0% chance that could be specific to you because there's
Right.
not been enough time for a prescription to be sent and sent back. There
Right.
are med spas that could be potentially sourcing office use compounded semaglutide from 503B outsourcing facilities. Those are bigger organizations that must follow CGMP guidelines, so they're held to a higher standard than 503A pharmacies, and they're allowed to compound in bulk for office use or office administration. A patient, all they would need to do when they get receive that that prescription medication, it would legally have to have a label on it. You would be able to tell where it comes from. If it comes from Joe's ABC Pharmacy, there'd be a very good chance that, like, how did that happen?
Right.
This is supposed to be a patient-specific prescription. But if it came with the name of one of these very big outsourcing facilities, I think that you might have a better sense of safety in the product because of the rigorous standards that those guys must follow. But it's kind of the same. It's like people see these advertisements for med spas or telehealth companies, and we keep having to correct, yes, but that's not pharmacy. Those are
Right.
separate companies. Like, they have their own business models, and we should ask them where they're getting their semaglutide because shouldn't in the normal way of doing pharmacy be from a 503A pharmacy unless there's is some time between the patient visit and either the patient being shipped or picked up the medication at that clinic at a later date. But if it's instantaneous, that doesn't seem like it goes with the 503A model.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess.
Tennille, talk a bit about real quickly the process a pharmacist goes through to validate a prescription and that relationship that I mentioned.
I'm sure Jeff is, familiar with the triad, the, pharmacist,
Right.
physician, patient relationship. Pharmacist has a duty to, make sure that a prescription written for a patient is written under the, typical prescriber patient relationship status. Like they can't just fill things based on a patient filling out a questionnaire. And we have, that corresponding responsibility to ensure that the patient was seen in good faith. Telemedicine does make that a little more challenging because there can be asynchronous visits and things like that. But it is the pharmacist's duty to make sure that that prescription was written by an appropriate prescriber for an appropriate patient for an appropriate indication.
If a patient is going to a med spa, is the suggestion to to have the patient ask where they're getting that from and ensure that it's a 503B
I mean, that's what
pharmacy? Or
I would
what would
do.
be the recommendation? Because I think pharmacists get that question, like, how do I know?
Yeah.
Because they're
So,
just
I
going
mean,
in, like, just trusting the system.
that's what I would do if I was a
Okay. Yeah.
patient. If you get a vial and it's not labeled or any, if you get pre-filled syringes without a label on it, like
Yeah,
I
that's
wouldn't
a
use
red flag. But I think
it.
patients don't know that.
No,
You know
they
what I mean?
don't.
Like, I think
And
they're so
yeah.
trusting. So
I
that would
mean, I
be
no.
like
I think
insurance.
that's I guess that's my concern is that I don't think the average patient would even think to ask. And I
Yeah.
think in all honesty, they probably don't want to know. They, I mean, I'm seriously, they've heard this miracle drug. They can't get it from their doctor or they can't afford it because their insurance won't pay for it. And around here in Des Moines, you can get 3 months of semaglutide at these spas for $700, cash money on the barrel head. And I think that yeah, I mean, even if they wanted to ask, I suspect they're like, well, it's probably okay. And so I mean, I think the point is that yeah, I mean, I think in a perfect world we would have patients say, okay, where exactly are you getting this from? Or, I mean, can you tell me, can you walk me through that? So I mean, I suspect that there's a disincentive to do that. And I also suspect that if COVID taught me anything is that the effective health literacy of the average patient is zero. So, I think I see where you guys are coming from, and I get that, it's kind of a different model. But I think the question my physicians ask is, well, how do I know when my patients come to me and say, hey, I was going to go to this med spa, and I can get a 3 month supply of this stuff from the nurse practitioner there for $700. Is that a good idea? And I think that my physicians ask me all the time that question. And I suspect ask you guys, the media probably ask you guys those questions. And I hate to say, don't trust med spas. I hate to say, I don't want to make a sweeping generalization because I have no doubt that there are ethical places out there that are using 503A pharmacy, that are actually getting the prescription and maybe the pharmacy's across the street or they'll have it mailed to them or something along those lines. So I hate to tell my providers, tell your patients don't use med spas. They wouldn't listen anyway, but I would tell them, don't, I mean, we can't do that. So I wish there was an easier way, like I wish I could just say, if the spa or wherever they're using it has the Alliance for Pharmacy Compounding approval, symbol on it, you can trust them, sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
I know, and if there is a if there's a way short of calling them or doing that, I think that would really help my providers a lot.
Yeah, well, we are not good housekeeping. I wish we were. We don't necessarily have a seal of approval. But I do think if the patient's going to a prescriber in the first place, the prescriber should at least consider whether or not he or she can write that script for that particular patient and send it to a state licensed pharmacy rather than having the patient go to a med spa. And again, I'm not anti-med spa. I'm sure there are
Sure.
some that are performing to the highest levels of rigor. But I also know, to your point, that it can be a sketchy enterprise as well. And frankly, that splashes on legitimate compounding. And
Sure does. It
that's
sure
part of what
does.
this sort of conversation, we hope to help clear that up.
The other question I sometimes guess, and we kind of talked about this offline before, you do occasionally see compounding orders that will have, vitamins with the semaglutide, add a little B12 or a little B6. And I think, again, there's some confusion out there. And Scott, I'm glad you kind of, talked about this, is that, well, we're kind of skirting the FDA rules because we're adding something to a compounded product that doesn't exist, commercially, right? I think there's some confusion out there that.
Well, I would not call it skirting FDA rules. I think what the FDA rules say is if there's a clinical benefit in the judgment of the prescriber, that adding that to an FDA-approved drug will have that clinical benefit for the patient, then it's not skirting the rules. It's well within the rules, and
Okay.
it's serving that patient's needs. I think, as Tennille will tell you, as the clinician, the question is, what is clinical benefit? When is it a legitimate clinical benefit? The interesting thing right now is that what's being done by many, many compounding pharmacies, these sterile compounding pharmacies, is they are making an exact copy of the FDA-approved version of the drug. And they're allowed to do that as long as the drug's on the shortage list. The drug is off the shortage list, and then we enter into a world where compounders can't make a copy of the drug. But if the prescriber judges that a combination of semaglutide and something else would have a clinical difference for the patient, then they can prescribe that, and the compounding pharmacy can prepare it. But again, the question goes back to what is clinical difference and who gets to decide?
Actually, Tennille, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, so some of these prescribers are asking for these kind of combinations. So, a lot of times the pharmacy hasn't just like decided that this is what they're going to
Oh,
make. But
no. Yeah, all right.
we all know we give pyridoxine injections to pregnant women that can't stop puking. We all know that, vitamin B12 could be a problem for patients on a very low calorie diet, not eating enough fruits and vegetables. But I agree that these combinations right now aren't always necessary from a legal standpoint, because pharmacies are allowed to compound an essential copy of an FDA approved product. But when and if Ozempic and Wegovy come off the drug shortage list, there may be opportunities for patients that would benefit from these combination products and could still potentially continue to receive these kind of things that are not copies because they are novel combination products. But we don't know when that's going to happen. Semaglutide is a patented medication, but it is no longer covered under exclusivity. So it has a little bit more legal space for compounders to make alternate dosage forms or alternate combinations once it does come off the drug shortage list. Tirzepatide is currently still a new chemical entity and covered under exclusivity. So that one is going to be have some different legal challenges if, Mounjaro just comes off the drug shortage list or Zepbound.
I mean, my guess is neither of those drugs will probably come off the shortage list anytime soon. I mean, I hear they're just like almost impossible to get. And honestly, I think the only thing that's going to cause those drugs to come off the shortage list is the triple G drug that's probably going to get approved, this year or early next, because it'll be one more drug in the marketplace. And frankly, the data blows even GLP-1 drugs out of the water, as far as its ability to have people lose weight. It's actually, at least as good, if not better, than bariatric surgery, which is just absolutely gobsmacking, So yeah, I it's I, you know it, it, the joke is that eventually, like statins, everybody will be on these drugs. I mean, sooner or later, everybody will be on these medications. So
Well, and the indications for the drugs keep expanding.
exactly, yeah.
Cardio health. Last week, I saw that there were indications that it may help with Parkinson's patients. I joke, I'm waiting for them to determine that semaglutide would be great to cure male pattern baldness. That will kill me.
That would literally be the absolute holy grail of drugs, wouldn't
Absolutely.
it?
Yeah.
If it
That's what I
caused your
said.
hair to grow back and you lost weight, yeah, it would
Yeah.
literally be the holy grail of drugs.
That's what I said, from my lips to God's ear. I do want to say one other thing about combination drugs, because there is something going on out there that causes us concern, and it is combination drugs that are semaglutide plus substances that don't meet the criteria for compounding. They're not a component of an FDA-approved drug. They don't have a USP or NF monograph, and they're not on FDA's 503A bulks list. There are certain peptides where prescribers are continuing aggressively and avidly to write and send to pharmacies, and pharmacies should not be combining those impermissible substances. They tend to be peptides, B157, et cetera. FDA has categorized those where they cannot be compounded. Now, the dirty little secret here, and I mentioned BP157 in particular, there are others. You can walk down to your local health food store, you can go on Amazon.com, and you can buy that supplement and take it to your heart's delight. But FDA has taken it, in effect, taken it off the market for compounders. And we are seeing some of that going on. And we would urge compounding pharmacies not to fill scripts for those banned substances. And we would urge prescribers to understand that they are banned substances and you shouldn't be writing scripts for them.
I totally agree. So last thing I wanted to touch on, I don't want to take too much of your guys' time. Jenna, you might have a question or two too, is we talked about this offline too. Not only is subcutaneous GLP-1 drugs now being looked at, you know, there are other dosage forms. I mean, obviously there's an oral form of semaglutide, doesn't seem to be quite as effective at, in weight loss, probably bioavailability would be my guess is one of the big reasons. But sublingual GLP-1 drugs. So maybe Tennille, you could speak to, you know, what you know about that. Cause again, I'm already getting questions from my docs about it.
Sure. And when providers first were asking me about sublingual forms for patients that are, you know, deathly afraid of injections or worried about refrigeration, I was like, this molecule is way too big for sublingual absorption. This doesn't make any sense from a pharmacological, pharmacokinetic standpoint. However, one of the suppliers of API has come up with a novel base to put the API in that they've done in vitro studies showing that this special base will help transport the semaglutide molecule across models of the sublingual tissue in a patient's mouth. And they're recommending that instead of using API, that pharmacists are crushing Rybelsus tablets. So they're trying to create a non-injectable, non-oral dosage form for patients that will meet the criteria for compounding after drug shortage problem is resolved, because sublingual
doesn't
formulations
exist.
Don't exist in the marketplace.
Right.
And when a drug is not on the shortage list, technically you should be using the finished product for compounding. So this company is recommending crushing Rybelsus tablets, putting it in this special base for sublingual absorption, and then the patient puts that solution in their cheek or under their tongue for a minute or so every day. Supposedly it reduces GI side effects compared to oral dosage forms. I mean, we all know the injectable dosage forms have plenty of GI side effects without
sure
being
do.
Swallowed. So, but it's also an option to help it, you know, expand access. There's not as many sterile compounding pharmacies as there are other types of non, you know, compounding pharmacies in the country. And non-sterile compounding is less complex, has less regulation, you know,
right.
It's just more accessible to patients. So it, you know, hopefully it will be a way to expand access to patients and, you know, not step on any patent toes, especially because pharmacies are supposed to be using the finished drug product to compound it. Because the doses are so much smaller sublingually, they're like 1 milligram a day or so compared to Rybelsus, which is 14 milligrams a couple times a day, something like that. It still ends up being, you know, not cost prohibitive for the compounder to make.
Right. And as you point out, you know, yeah, I mean, because it's not sterile, you wouldn't need to put it in a 797 and all that other stuff. Yeah, again, because again, I've just barely started hearing of this. Are you hearing where the, you know, cause that's the question I'm going to get asked is it cheaper? Will they probably get it for less money than say compounded subcutaneous GLP-1 drugs?
I haven't heard the price comparison compared to the compounded subcutaneous versions. You know, likely it will be less expensive than the brand name products, and that's only a function of the less cost that's going to go into it from marketing and research and development, advertising, all of those kind of things that the brand name companies have. You know, a little individual compounding pharmacy doesn't have those kind of overhead costs to cover in pricing their medications. But I haven't heard, I would imagine if I had to guess, it's probably going to be similar to the injectable product, but that is just my guess. I haven't heard of any actual pricing.
Right. Fair enough. My last question, you know, I have no doubt that the manufacturers, you know, of the drugs are, you know, I'm sure they're not, you know, often thrilled about compounding pharmacies, you know, Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly are probably not jumping up and down about the fact that compounding pharmacies are doing this, you know, trying to help patients. In your opinion, what has been their message, which I'm sure has been absolutely don't do that. And, but how are you, because I'm sure they're telling prescribers that, so what can we tell prescribers to say, hey, look, I get it. This is a business thing. They want to, maintain their, maintain their profit margins and all other stuff, but this is an absolutely viable, ethical, legal way to deliver medications to patients who need them.
Yeah, the message to prescribers ought to be, if you can acquire FDA approved Wegovy, Ozempic, Mounjaro, Zepbound, et cetera, Rybelsus for a patient, and that is the right prescription in your judgment for the patient, that's what you ought to prescribe. But we're in a world right now where those are hard to come by, and it's not fair, it's not rational, and it's not compassionate to say to a patient, you're going to have to do without this life-changing medication until we can manage our supply chain better.
Right.
And again, FDA guidance allows it. Sterile compounding pharmacies is adhere to the high and rigorous regulatory framework. And I think patients can be confident that what they're getting from a state-licensed compounding pharmacy is legitimate and is going to do for them what it purports to do. I do want to say one game that Novo and Lilly are playing is filing lawsuits against
Course.
compounding pharmacies. Now, they filed lawsuits against some med spas as well, and the claims against the med spas are that the med spas are advertising generic Wegovy or compounded Ozempic, and those are big no-nos under federal law. And compounding pharmacies know that you should not market using the brand name. On the other hand, they filed six or eight, both Lilly and Novo, lawsuits against legitimate compounding pharmacies for following the FDA guidance about essentially a copy to the letter. They've also made statements that they have acquired injectable compounded semaglutide and found impurities, that's the word they use, or potency discrepancies. The problem has been that Novo and Lilly have gotten great headlines out of those claims, but nobody's asked them to show their work.
Of course not.
Nobody has said, Eli Lilly, how did a company get its hands on a prescription that was dispensed to an individual patient? And beyond that, even if you did get your hands on it, how old was it? Had it been properly refrigerated? Because all of those matter in terms of the potency of the drug. And so like I say, they've made great headlines. They've been two by half with it, but nobody is asking them to show their work.
And that's good to hear. And again, I think that's an important message that I think that it's an important message to hear from compounding pharmacists and people who are versed in this sort of thing. So Jen, did you have any other questions?
Yeah, I just had one that I think something you just said, Scott, kind of leads into it. But we talked a little bit offline before we started that, one of the issues is that, compounding medications is complex and there are a lot of layers. I think, Tennille, you referred to it. I mean, I've even learned a lot of things. I'm like, okay, wait, like following through the chain and, what is legal, what isn't, and, how do you talk about the different compounding pharmacies, that sort of thing. So, Scott, you talked about one of the problems is physicians don't understand that at all. So if us as pharmacists are confused and this is our space and, we only learn so much about it in pharmacy school, physicians aren't getting any of this. And so, to Jeff's point, and I think we've talked about it a little bit, but, how can we better educate physicians on this? And as an organization, do you know of any education that we can point physicians to so that they do understand how this all works and can feel confident in prescribing what's needed for patients?
Again, I want to reiterate, hopefully, there will be no confusion. FDA-approved drugs, which many, all prescribers, I guess, have some understanding of. They got it in medical school, first line of therapy. Anecdotally, I have a son who next month graduates from the University of Florida School of Medicine. He's doing internal medicine. He's headed off to Michigan for a residency.
I work with medicine residents, so
Oh, good.
good to hear he's
Good.
being a primary care doc. We need primary
Yeah,
care docs.
we're headed to Ann Arbor next week to look for an
Ah,
apartment. But at any rate, he's
makes me
gone
think.
through 4 years of medical school and has never heard about compounded drugs. So we have all these medical students coming out thinking, I mean, they've only got one arrow in their quiver and it's FDA approved drugs. And so that's part of the problem. There's not enough conversation about these therapies that are enshrined in legislation and regulation. with a purpose to assure that patients can continue to get the care they need even when a drug is in shortage. And so we would urge prescribers who are interested in compounding in general, compounded drugs in general, not just GLP-1s, to talk with their local compounding pharmacy. I think they will find the pharmacist delighted to share what they do. And it is complex, by the way. We work with a lot of reporters and report every there are no black and white answers. So if you ask me, can compounders create a copy of an FDA-approved drug? The answer is no. Except, and almost everything in compounding is nuanced and has that except in there. And that makes it very difficult to understand. Tennille, you may want to talk a bit about how you have educated prescribers and maybe some suggestions for how they learn more about compounding.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that the statement to call your local compounder is great. I think that physicians having a relationship with a compounding pharmacist, whether they prescribe compounded GLP-1s, is really great. Compounding pharmacists can be a huge resource for prescribers that have patients that have difficult problems to solve. That's our entire job as compounders, is thinking outside of the box, looking at a patient's problem and figuring out ways to help the physician solve it. And that's what compounding pharmacists really do best. APC has on its website some resources for physicians talking about compounding regulatory framework. We have a statement for physicians on peptides. We can provide resources as well if physicians have questions. I think there's trainings that physicians can go to learn more about compounded drugs, but that's typically in the integrative medicine space. But I think that a continuing education topic like what you guys are doing is a great first step in, opening their eyes. Because I think if I didn't know a lot about something either, my first instinct would be like, no, thank you, because my duty is to protect my patients. And if I don't feel confident, then that would make me worried. I understand that.
It's such a it's like the ultimate like clinical, ethical, legal, all the complexities all in this one issue. So it is hard to understand. And I think it is their job as pharmacists to help educate physicians about that and help them feel confident in taking best care of the patient. To your point, like that's the ultimate goal for all of us.
One thing I would like to point out is most physicians have no idea how many compounded drugs are being administered to their patients without their knowledge. There's a lot of shortages in the marketplace. A lot of 503B outsources are supplying things like lidocaine injections, bicarb, all sorts of stuff like that to hospitals that are being routinely administered to their patients as part of their therapy. And no, none of them are being like, oh no, about that kind of stuff. There's just kind of a lot of hysteria on this side because of the media coverage. But if they really knew how many compounded drugs are being administered, they might have a little bit more ease of mind.
I think that's also within the four walls of a hospital. And when you talk about ambulatory and, that gets a little scarier. So yeah, it's a great point.
And I think that's the thing, is that the general public doesn't realize that, as to your point, that lots of medications in a hospital setting are outsourced to 403Bs or are made by admixtures in our own, in our own hospitals. So last word, Scott, Tennille, what would you like to what's the message you want our listeners to walk away with?
Well, we appreciate this opportunity. As we said, compounding has been around literally for thousands of years. It's where pharmacy began. It's been a part of the American healthcare system for generations. It's just been sort of hidden from the sort of hospital compounding that we've just talked about to, we haven't even mentioned veterinary compounding, where compounding is almost the norm rather than the exception. I guarantee your listeners know somebody, or maybe themselves have taken a compounded medication. And I think the GLP-1 craze, phenomenon, whatever you'd like to call it, is now shining light on a practice, hopefully in a positive way. A lot of what we've seen is not very positive, and our job is to demonstrate that this is more than legitimate. It is life enhancing, and that's what compounding pharmacies do.
Tennille?
I would just like to, I guess, kind of reiterate that a lot of the things being covered in the media are not compounding, but they're being confused with compounding. And if a patient does see a practitioner and get issued a prescription for a compounded medication, if they want to call and speak to the pharmacist, a pharmacist will have a duty to speak to that patient and answer questions. If you can't get that, those answers, then, it might be something that you might reconsider taking or injecting into your body. And I appreciate so much the chance to be able to talk to you guys and, be able to hopefully reach your audience. And if anyone in your audience has questions or needs clarification or wants to know about testing processes or anything related to the compounding of GLP-1s, they're more than welcome to reach out to me, and I am happy to have a phone call, send them an email, whatever they want, to walk them through the process to help, further educate your members on how this all works.
Really
That's
appreciate
great.
that. Yeah. And Jen, I'm sure we can put the website in the show notes,
Yes,
and your
absolutely. I
guys's
was just
contact
going to say
information.
that too. I think we'll put Tennille, if you're okay with that, we'll put your contact information in the show notes. And also the website is A4A and then the letter or the number four, PC.org. So if anybody has more questions or wants to know more about your organization, this has been so helpful. I
Yeah,
have
I
learned
agree.
a ton. And so I'm really just appreciative of both of you and your time. I know you're just coming off of a big conference, so I know how that goes, and your time is limited, and especially with this topic, I'm sure you have lots to do. So I really appreciate you being on with us today. And that's it for this week. So if you are a CE plan member, be sure to claim your CE for this episode by logging into CEimpact.com. And as always, have a great week and keep learning. We'll talk to you next week.